Hi there, I'm Ian Willoughby, and this is episode 57 of Prague Talk, a podcast from Radio Prague International. And this time out, my guest is Martin Klíma. Martin was a student leader of Czechoslovakia's Velvet Revolution, helping organize the gathering in November 1989 that actually sparked the fall of communism, where he delivered a key speech. While some other student leaders then went into politics, Martin chose to enter business instead. Inspired by his beloved Dungeons & Dragons, he created the huge hit role-playing board game Dragon's Lair, which, like things such as commercial TV and the arrival of McDonald's, helped define the 1990s in this country. Intent on also finding international success, he later moved into computer games and was a co-founder of Warhorse Studios. Their 2018 game, Kingdom Come Deliverance, has sold a whopping 4 million copies worldwide. I spoke to Martin Klíma at the company's offices in the shiny new Libeng Docks District for this episode of Prague Talk. First thing I'd like to ask you is about the fact that you were born in the UK. Tell us about how you came to be born in Britain.
My parents defected from Czechoslovakia in 1968 in the wake of the Russian invasion, and they first went to Austria and then they went to England. My father was a physicist, or he is a physicist, and he was able to get a job at the University of Bristol as a research assistant, and his wife, my mother, came with him, and thus a year later, I was born in Bristol. But they were actually able to legalize their stay in UK retroactively and turn it into a prolonged business trip or like a sabbatical.
So they didn't get in trouble when they came back to Czechoslovakia? Yeah,
so they were able to come back to Czechoslovakia without severe repercussion. However, my father was—he never made a career in Czechoslovakia. Once he came back, he was a research assistant till 1999, and only then he got a promotion or the scientific recognition that he was due. And the question for my parents is if they were sorry they came back, and honestly, I'm not quite sure, because living abroad without possibility to come back and with the possibility to get in touch with your parents or relatives and friends is very hard. And of course, a lot of people did it, and some of them flourished, some of them not. And it's one of these like big life decisions. I'm actually quite happy I didn't have a say in the decision. I was just 18 months old when we came back.
And growing up, what was your relationship to communism, to the authorities? Were your family political, for example?
When I was growing up in this normalization Czechoslovakia, my uncle is Ivan Klíma, the famous Czech writer and dissident. So, of course, I was sort of involved in this, but very indirectly. I never thought myself to be part of the opposition or to be part of the dissent. It was just this very common situation, I think, that you are taught from very early age that you have to speak one way at home and the other way at school, and you have to be careful about what you are saying to authorities or what you are saying to your teachers. And of course, as I was getting older, I sort of were able to get better understanding of what's going on in my country.
What were your introductions to the worlds of science fiction and fantasy growing up?
Well, it was one of the things that had big influence on me. And actually, I married a science fiction writer, so that really changed my life in a most profound way. In the totalitarian regime, there were these pockets of certainly not resistance, but of certain independence. These sort of independent groups usually coalesced around some innocuous topics, could be gardening or tourism, or could be science fiction. And that's what I was attracted to. And I think this is firstly because there were very few alternatives of what to do, because the official literature was much more controlled and much more ideologically aligned with the official party line. And secondly, certainly because of some inherent qualities of science fiction as a genre, because then in the 80s, this kind of technological optimism was, I dare to say, more common than it is today. And I, for one, sort of miss it in today's discourse.
You first heard about Dungeons & Dragons, the game, from a bizarre-sounding magazine article. What was in that article?
Yeah, it was called The Death Lurks in the Dragon's Den. The article basically was a sort of distillation of articles which were part of what today I know is was this satanic panic, moral panic in the US in the 70s. And one thing that got swept into it was the D&D, because, of course, in D&D you are casting, quote-unquote, casting spells, and you pretend to be a mage or a cleric or what have you, and, of course, it's easy to get it confused with some kind of pagan ritual or whatever. So I think this is the reason why it was sort of disparaged by certain fringe groups in American society. And of course, the news we got from the world beyond the Iron Curtain was heavily filtered, and the filter really amplified all these fringe elements. So we got this constant stream of news that these decaying imperialistic societies on the verge of self-destruction, and certainly that fit the picture very well, but it was so weird that it caught my attention, and I thought that I would love to learn more about it. And then I got an opportunity because my father was allowed by the late 80s, he was allowed to travel to UK again, and actually to the University of Bristol again, and to have some lectures there and do some work. So then I was able to persuade my parents to obtain a set of rules, the basic D&D, and that changed my life forever.
I guess one thing also that at least impacted your life a lot was when you became friends with Marek Benda, who's now very famous as the longest-serving MP in the Czech lower house. He came from a well-known dissident family. How did it impact you spending time with Marek Benda and his family?
Actually, we got acquainted through science fiction first, because he, for similar reasons I've outlined, was interested in this genre as well. And he approached me because he was interested in getting some of the SF books that I had. So we were able to exchange them. And then one thing leads to another, and we became friends. And of course, this had a big impact on my life as well, because then it led directly to my involvement in the student protests in 1999.
And you and he, you started a kind of independent student union in the summer of 89.
Yeah, that's right. And it was not just me and him. Before that, there was a plan to replace the buildings of the Faculty of Mathematics and Physics, where I was studying, and Marek also was studying, by some new development, which I thought would be a terrible shame. So I started a petition, and actually the petition was signed by hundreds of people, the staff and students of the faculty, and people outside it. So it was really a sign that the things are changing. And this petition, this was my initiative, but then I talked to Marek about it, and he suggested that we could try to create an independent student union in our faculty. And so we approached the dean, and of course he said that, thank you, it's a very commendable idea, but let's not do it. And then we thought, okay, well, obviously we reached the end, like this is as far as we can get using purely legal means working within the system. And now if we want to get further, we have to work outside the system, and that's why we got involved with students of other schools and faculties in establishing this independent student union.
But is it the case that you were involved with the organization of the now, of course, very famous November 17th demonstration or gathering that became a demonstration in conjunction with the Union of Socialist Youth?
Yeah, I mean, we in that independent union, we wanted to use some well-known anniversary or some special day to organize a demonstration where we would be able to read some kind of manifesto and ask people to join us. And in this late 80s, ever since, I think, 88, there were regular anti-regime demonstrations. I, for one, felt that there is no progress being made. There were a few thousand people at the demonstrations. There were usually almost as many policemen. They would use water cannons and truncheons to disperse the demonstration. There wouldn't be that many serious repercussions. They wouldn't imprison people or get them ejected from their schools or jobs, so on. But yeah, you could get beaten and you could get some kind of trouble into. But it was not like everyone would get in trouble. So it was relatively low risk endeavor for the participants. But at the same time, the possibility of repercussions was so high that only few people were willing to take the risk. So I felt that we've again reached the limits of where we can go. And if we want to organize a demonstration where more people would be involved and where people would come, we need some kind of official fig leaf for that. And there was a big discussion about that, because of course people in that nascent independent student organization would object to involving the Socialist Union of Youth, which was really just an arm of the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia. But in the end we were able to persuade them that this is a good idea, and this is the kind of compromise that we have to make in order to attract more people and to win over these wavering, silent majority people.
So it gave people the confidence to take part because it was legal, it could be advertised, it was an official event.
Right. And of course, because it was official event, we were also able to get like proper sound apparatus, stage equipment, and we were able to attract many more people to the demonstration than we would if it was just another independent anti-regime demonstration. And of course we had to make some compromise. We had to agree on who will be talking at the demonstration.
In your speech that you delivered at Albertov on that day, you referred to the events of 1939, when the Nazis persecuted the Czech students. And you said also that servitude was worse than death. You referred also to the future, which sound like strong words by the standards of that time. What were your feelings as you were delivering these words to this crowd at Albertov in November 89?
I was chosen by this very small group of people that were organizing the demonstration as their representative, because they thought that I have the best delivery of the speech, and then probably like the timbre of my voice or something like that. So I really focused on not failing them. I was not thinking that much about the world-changing consequences that were about one fault, but I was really focusing on speaking slowly so I could be understood and delivering my lines with precision and the right kind of stress and articulation, enunciation.
Well, I've heard part of your speech and you certainly succeeded in that. One thing I wanted to ask you also is, everyone knows what happened after that speech on that day, but when did you feel in the following days that the revolution was won? Maybe you didn't use the word revolution, but that the change had been made?
Well, I remember it actually quite distinctly. I think it was either Tuesday or Wednesday after the next week when we started the student strike. And then I think on Tuesday there were rumors that the People's Militia, which was kind of armed, they called themselves the Armored Fist of the Working Class, but in reality it was a bunch of elderly men that pretended to be soldiers. And there was rumors that the Communist Party would use them to crush the revolution, if we can call it that, or crush the strike at any rate, right, by force. And in the meantime, I became the part of this central strike committee that was organizing the student strike. So we felt that we need to take some measures in case this happens, and we wrote a sort of proclamation that we might be crushed, but we are not defeated, or something to that effect. And we took two copies of that, or maybe just actually one copy of that proclamation. We went to U.S. Embassy and tried to persuade the U.S. Charge d'Affaires to make a copy of it, and he was very hesitant about it. And then we went to Russian Embassy, and then we waited for maybe an hour until somebody was free to talk to us. And then a Russian came to us and he read the proclamation, and we explained that we want him to have it in case that something happens to us. Because you have to understand that at that moment the Soviet, actually it was not Russian embassy, it was embassy of the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union at the time, headed by Mr. Gorbachev, seemed like a more progressive, a more democratic state than our own state. And so we sort of felt that they might have some kind of leverage over the Czech Communist Party bosses. So that guy in the embassy read it and then said, I think you don't have to worry, or something, words to that effect. And at that moment, I felt like it's over.
After the revolution, you didn't want to enter politics, saying that you weren't experienced enough. Tell us about your beginnings in the area that you did go into, which was games production.
This goes back to my story about D&D. And in the late 80s, there was a growing movement of underground science fiction literature, which was really very apolitical. It was not actual samizdat, and it was not
something like fanzines?
Yeah, it was something like fanzines, and it was usually produced with more sophisticated equipment than just actual samizdat that's written on a typewriter and with carbon copy paper. So what we've seen was that people, most factories, what was called the national enterprise, these communist factories and companies, they usually had some resources for printing their own company magazines or guidebooks or whatever they were needed to be printed. And these people working in these positions, they were able to illegally publish limited quantities of books and fanzines, and like short story collections and so on. And these were usually translated from English by people for free. And of course, the authors never got a penny from this kind of publication. And then the printing run was maybe 50, maybe 100 copies. and it was sold or exchanged with other people that were in this same area. And that's, I have several boxes of books like that at home to this day. And so once I played D&D for a while, I really wanted to share it with other people in Czechoslovakia. So I, with my future wife, translated it in Czech and with the view of publishing it. But before we could do that, the revolution came and the whole landscape has changed, and now it was possible to publish it legally. So I approached the copyright holders, TSR, and I never got any response from them. And of course, the end of the regime also meant the end to the barriers of entry for books and magazines from abroad. So we got acquainted with this genre of role-playing games and realized that D&D is an important and the first one, but still only one of the games in the genre, and the genre is actually much wider. And because it's first, in a way, it's also, it has certain limitations of imagination that is necessarily part of any work that is sets out to create something completely new. And so the conclusion was that we actually would be able to create a similar game ourselves when we take the good bits that we liked about D&D and we added some other good bits we liked in other games, and then we added some bits that we created completely ourselves, by ourselves, and published the new game. And we did, and we named the new game Dragon Slayer, or Dragon's Den, in honor of that article that I mentioned earlier. And this was really tremendously successful because it was the exact right moment where everybody was looking for these new things, new ways of entertainment, and nobody knew about it. And it was like famous or well-known pastime in the other countries, but especially in US, but really was completely unfamiliar to people in Czechoslovakia. So we were able to sell many thousand copies very quickly, and we wrote sequels, and then we published various expansions and so on.
You've had, of course, phenomenal success with Warhorse Studios, in particular with Kingdom Come Deliverance, which sold, I don't know, millions of copies. I was thinking that must be the biggest kind of cultural product from the Czech Republic, more than any movies, literature, music, anything. Do you feel like the games industry gets the recognition that it deserves in the Czech Republic?
Well, one should be very careful what he wishes for. In 1880s, there was a famous accident in, well, maybe not that famous, there was an accident in Cairo, actually, Sea of Cairo. Some royal guests were supposed to arrive to Cairo, and the British fleet at the time wanted to make some ceremonial welcome to them. And the warships of the fleet were ordered by the admiral of the fleet to form two columns that would move in parallel, and that a signal would be made, and the leading ship would turn inwards, and then they would form two lines in parallel going in the opposite direction. And the two lines were ordered by the admiral to be 80 cables apart, and the captains of the ship pointed out that the turning radius of their ships is 40 feet. So if they are 60 feet apart, then they will collide on the inward arc. But they were dismissed and said, well, obviously you can't follow direct orders. And that's what you are supposed to do. You are not here to think, you are here to execute orders. So they actually went there, they formed two lines, they started turning, and then the two front ships actually collided. They didn't sink, I think, but it's amazing display of this kind of institutional stupidity. Like, you have the Navy that used to be the best Navy in the world just 70 years ago. It defeated French in Napoleonic Wars, and it was this like pinnacle of naval achievement, machine that kept this biggest empire in the history together. And obviously it was attracting people who were not into it because they liked ships and because they felt like they liked the Navy, or that they had any sort of aptitude for this. They just liked the prestige and the status that came with it. And when these people were called on making decisions, it had these catastrophic results. And this is an inevitable consequence of any field getting the prestige and recognition that it deserves. And this is going to happen with the computer games once this happened, and this is bound to happen. And we are very lucky that we don't have this kind of prestige and recognition that we deserve.
Many thanks indeed to Martin Klima. To say that I enjoyed our interview would be a major understatement. This has been episode 57 of Prague Talk. So if you're new to us, why not check out the previous ones and subscribe, as they say, wherever you get your podcasts. For now, thanks very much indeed for listening to Prague Talk, and talk to you again very soon.